We conclude this morning's program with Joe Clement talking with trained chef and journalist Arun Gupta about the American food system under conditions of the pandemic. Joe?
Thanks, Denise. Well, you may have heard of how the food supply chain is almost broken, how because of the lockdown, different parts of how we produce, move, and procure our food is being threatened. My guest today, Arun Gupta, is a journalist who is covering COVID and its impact on farm workers, but he has a broader background in the food system as a trained chef and a food critic with a book coming out, Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction, a Junk Food Loving Chef's Inquiry into Taste. He's written for Washington Post, The Intercept, Jacobin, The Guardian, and his latest article about COVID and farm workers is going to be published through In These Times. Thanks, Arun, for coming on The Old Mole today to talk about this most essential of human systems.
Great to be here with you.
Well, I wanted to talk about the different parts of the food system and how they're being affected by the pandemic and how they all fit together anyway. And most food, in one way or another, starts from the ground. And it takes human labor, in a lot of cases, to coax that food out of the ground.
What has been going on in America's farms? What is the state of our agricultural system? And how is it being impacted by the pandemic right now?
It's dramatic. I think the best way to think about it is there's this very famous anthropologist in food studies, Sidney Mintz. He's often called the founder or father of food studies. He once said that nothing changes food and food systems more than war. And so we think of this like a war, and you have your own government essentially waging war on you. Then we begin to understand the scale at which food systems are being disrupted. So everyone is experiencing this. You know, you can't really go to restaurants anymore, grocery stores, unless you come from another country. You never encountered shortages or rationing in your lifetime. You have to go back to World War II. We see this the whole system breaking down. So you have these shortages in the grocery store. Meanwhile, at the same time, there are estimates that as many as 10 million hogs might be euthanized by June because meat processing plants have become hotspots of a coronavirus due to the cramped working conditions, lack of worker rights and protections, the cold temperatures also. So there's been outbreaks at least 115 beef, pork, and poultry plants across the country, and so they don't have the processing country. And this also has a lot to do with kind of the monopoly control where you just have a few firms now controlling meat processing. And so you can't just tell animals to stop growing, and so they're having to kill off all these animals. But one thing that is getting left out is the farm workers, which, you know, we need to think about a lot more.
And that's because these folks are also working in very cramped situations, or they're living in them often near the farms. And they are the people who make sure that anything gets out of the ground and get to people.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in terms of obviously mechanization has been going on in the farms for a long time. But other than kind of like grain and oil crops, soy, corn, wheat, rice, there isn't a lot of mechanical harvesting, you know, and we think about it, maybe that tomato, that nice looking hothouse tomato, those strawberries that you eat, well, someone had to pluck those, but agricultural workers do so much more. They're also helping to raise those hogs. They're in the chicken houses. I've been talking to dairy farm workers in upstate New York. We're taking care of hundreds of calves. They're tending to vines, grapevines. They're grafting them and plucking the grapes. If you would enjoy a bottle of wine, apples, oranges, whatever you can think of, any sort of fruit or vegetable is almost always going to involve farm workers. And, you know, I do want to make a point, like you see a lot of people, and in fact, there's a New York Times editorial today, oh, people need to give up meat because of the effects on the workers. If you want to go by that logic, you should basically give up all food. This idea of instrumentalizing people's oppression to try and fix another oppression is a really mistaken approach, because there are 2.5 million farm workers across the country. A majority of them are undocumented. And you made a really important point. It's not the working conditions, it's the living conditions where they are being exposed to coronavirus. And there are these outbreaks going on across the country among the people who pick your fruit and vegetables. They're just not getting as much publicity at a meat processing plant. But in upstate New York, for instance, there's a hydroponic farm, 1.4 million square feet under glass, that grows all sorts of vegetables, including huge amounts of tomatoes and strawberries. Half its workforce, 169 workers, came down with coronavirus because the labor subcontractor was packing them four to a motel room to a bed. In North Carolina, there are at least five different farms where there have been coronavirus outbreaks. In Oregon, Woodburn, Oregon, is the center of coronavirus infections in the state, and that's where there's lots of farm and farm workers as well. In central Washington state, there are outbreaks on various farms. So again, if you want to protect workers, you should stop eating all fruit. And in fact, in the last week, there have been at least seven different strikes in Yakima, Washington, among a workforce that's overwhelmingly Latino, striking against unsafe working conditions, demanding more hazard pay, and demanding proper PPE. So, you know, this is something that is much more hidden and getting much less reporting, because basically, as oppressed as meatpacking plant workers are, farm workers are far more oppressed. It's estimated anywhere from 48% at the low end to over 70% are undocumented. You have this ethno-nationalist president persecuting them in every single way, while also saying they're decreeing their essential workers. And so the farm workers we talked to, so many have said that they're afraid to get tested because they can't afford to lose their job. They can't afford to lose their income. Often their housing is tied to their job, and they normally work sick anyway. So we're creating the conditions for coronavirus outbreak throughout many rural areas in America.
There are other kinds of processing that goes on too, not just meat processing. Most of the food that we get, unless it's like fresh vegetables, goes through some degree of processing and packaging. And are those workers being affected in the same way?
You know, the thing is, when we think of processing also, you know, remember, even the, like, strawberries are processed. They're cleaned and washed. It isn't just going straight from the field onto your dinner plate. There is always some bit of processing. Now, what we think of is, like, industrial processing, like canning or flash freezing for fresh food. That's more intensive processing. Then you have the processing where you're taking, say, that rice and turning it into like rice-a-roni or minute rice or something like that. That involves a whole complicated chemical manufacturing process. So we're also seeing outbreaks in things like seafood plants, commercial bakeries, vegetable processing plants, any enclosed space where people are in sustained contact with each other. And so that's why we're seeing it spread in factories. We're also seeing it in warehouses. So all these areas where the goods are gathered, these central distribution points, and, you know, we have to remember, since we have this just-in-time production system, it relies on these massive distribution centers. And in fact, there are these mega distribution centers. So Walmart has, they've got maybe 100 distribution centers across the country, but then they have three huge distribution centers, some of the biggest warehouses in the world. For instance, in Southern California, in the Inland Empire, their complex of warehouses, there's something I think on the scale of like 3 million square feet. It would take you close to 20 minutes to walk across some of these warehouses. They're so vast. And when you have so many workers in that space, and if there's an outbreak there, think of how long it would take to disinfect it, an insanely long time, or you just have to quarantine it for weeks. So we're seeing this disruption throughout the distribution chain, and then obviously it moves on from there into the grocery stores.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Portland-based journalist and trained chef Arun Gupta about the food supply and the impact of coronavirus on it.
Michael Pollan has a forthcoming article in the New York Review of Books about the sickness in our food supply, And he points to the concentration of distribution networks. We've heard that there is all kinds of stress on the supply chain and that it's breaking down in some way. But the main issue that I've heard as far as supply and food having to be thrown out comes down to institutional buyers dropping out of these markets, because our system is a market system. The farmers or commodity food producers don't have a way of connecting their product to the set of people who get it from farm to whatever its ultimate destination is. Could you speak to that situation and really how insurmountable it is or isn't?
Yeah, I saw one that basically only 30% of our calories come through grocery stores. I did look at some research recently that said 21% of our calories comes through restaurants. But then you have things like the school lunch and breakfast program, which provides billions of meals a year to children. So that's a major supplier. You have institutional settings. You have things like the military, again, prison, living facilities, residential care, nursing care. And so now, like, trying to take this huge flow of water and shove it through a small space, and we're trying to push this massive amount of goods into grocery stores and through grocery stores. And you have simple things going on, like a lot of producers, a lot of agribusinesses, a lot of processors, they're not packaging flour in 5-pound bags. They're packaging them in 100-pound bags, if not even much bigger containers for industrial producers. So they don't have the means to just quickly ship to consumer sales. Then it's also a question of the market. Even if you could suddenly shift, well, who are you going to sell it through? Can't suddenly have everyone buying everything online, you know, from individual producers. That would be extremely inefficient. The reason we have supermarkets is because the idea you can go there and get all goods. You don't want to have to, like, order your eggs from the egg farm and everything individually. And then also a lot of stuff that we eat, and I've been noticing this, even though I'm a trained professional chef, trained in classical French cuisine, and I can cook all sorts of different cuisines, but I am not having the variety of food when they could go grab food at a restaurant or a bakery or 1,000 different places. So we find high demands for some food, like eggs, are flying off the shelf, and I find myself eating a lot more eggs. Why? Because it's something simple, it's nutritious, you get fat protein, it's very versatile. But then there's, say, like all sorts of different cuts of meat that people might normally eat, or the fact that a lot of vegetables are very labor intensive, and it looks like people are eating less vegetables than they were, because, you know, generally vegetables are not like calorie dense. You know, they're basically water that are nutrient and fiber delivery systems. And to prepare vegetables, it takes time, it takes knowledge, it takes skill. And so it looks like a lot of people aren't eating as much vegetables. And we may see this shock move through the supply chain because growers are making all sorts of guesses about what's going to sell and what isn't going to sell. So we could start to see, I don't think shortages, but maybe not as much supplies. And something that I've noticed is a lot of the specialty items, I cook a lot of different types of Asian cuisines, and I'm starting to see less of the specialty items that I would see, things like curry leaves, like lemongrass, various types of hot peppers. They appear to be disappearing, and maybe it's just an observation. The vegetables often at higher-end grocery stores don't look as good as they did a couple of months ago, because when you have this supply chain disruption, buyers are going to just try and buy wherever they can get from instead of, you know, prioritizing a certain appearance that they would in the past. And these are minor things, but they are, I think, important indicators of a food system that is undergoing all sorts of shocks. Again, the workers here are also very much on the front line. Like, I understand in Portland, the Kroger-owned Fred Meyer is trying to do away with hazard pay for workers. I've talked to people who go into stores who said for a long time the workers weren't being given PPE, whereas someplace like Whole Foods, the workers had PPE and had those plexiglass shields pretty quickly. So you can see how companies, Amazon is, of course, notorious for this. They've been firing workers who've been protesting the hazardous conditions inside the plant, even as they, Fred Meyer was erecting billboards like, you know, saluting its workers, but now they want to cut their pay. You know, that tells you everything you need to know about the corporate mindset, that they just use them as marketing tools while their profits are increasing massively because of the supply chain disruption. And one last point, April saw the largest rise in consumer prices for food apparently since the CPI began in post-World War II. So in over 70 years, it went up something like 2.6%. Which on an annualized basis is over 30%. So there's a distinct possibility that there may be price gouging and profiteering going on. But again, this is nothing new. There was all sorts of profiteering. The last time that Americans really had profound food shortages was World War I, and there was all sorts of profiteering and price gouging going on then as well.
What changes to the food system because of what the pandemic is forcing on producers and distributors, do you fear and or do you see as a positive possibility? In the Michael Pollan piece that I referenced, he says that, you know, this is showing why we need a more decentralized way of producing and distributing our food. And I'm wondering whether you see the situation as pushing us in that direction or just making us too dysregulated as a culture to deal with the problem.
You know, and with the 2008 financial crisis, what we saw is a lot of consolidation. And the prominent Marxist geographer, political economist David Harvey, very early on, he said, we're going to see upward concentration of wealth. And even, you know, as it was happening when in 2008, he was seeing that. And that seemed kind of like incredulous, but that's exactly what happened. So I think rather than see decentralization, in many ways, you're going to see more centralization. Now, having worked in the restaurant industry, you know, you'll often work for these like restaurant groups. And I'm sure there are plenty of them in Portland where there's like one restaurant who's very public, but they have like dozen restaurants. I think one of them is Alder and Sons. Is that right? That they have like a bunch of different restaurants and operations. And, you know, like anything else, it's economy of scale, right? You know, you're going to be more resilient if you have a dozen operations. And certainly they're not a chain, you know, they're high-end restaurant chain, but a lot of the most prominent chefs in America are suffering tremendously. And, you know, like David Chang, who's this very famous Korean-American New York restaurateur, he's like, I don't know if we're going to stay in business. And, you know, he has like multiple Netflix series. He's in the New York Times all the time. And he's like, if we can't stay in business, what does that say for all these mom and pop operations? And so early on, one of the things I was thinking may actually happen, and I don't have any evidence, but I think it's a correct speculation, that we may see the huge fast food companies, the huge chain restaurants, you know, Olive Garden, Chili's, Applebee's, actually start to move into fine dining, where they either start up or they bankroll these restaurant groups that are now going under or on the brink of going under. So we'll see greater consolidation of the food system. Certainly, you know, Amazon.com has just skyrocketed upward. It's since March, it's gone up something like 50%. You know, Jeff Bezos' wealth has increased by tens of billions of dollars. And so, sure, crisis points to a system that is fundamentally broken. But that was the whole thing about the 2008 Great Recession. Everyone was saying, well, this shows neoliberalism has failed. And it's just like, yeah, it's failed, but it's not just going to die on its own. The problem is, I think too many leftists think like a system is just going to collapse on its own. You have to organize. And not organize five of your friends. You have to organize millions of people with the political and social vision and force to change the system, because they're very powerful people, very ruthless people who are happy to kill millions to continue their political domination and accruing their wealth. And this is precisely what we're seeing with the pandemic, where we've heard one billionaire after another. They're like, get back to work, get back to work. People are going to die. Get back to work. Where they're happy to watch us die because their wealth depends on it. So I don't think that it's going to magically decentralize. This is a social battle that has to be organized and fought for in a very brutal manner.
That's a good note to end on. thank you so much, Arun Gupta, for coming on the Oval today to talk about the food system, its political and economic configuration.
Great being with you. Thank you, Joe.